Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
Hello, Cole Hornaday.
Well, hey.
Hey, Cole and Chris Gasso.
Hello.
How is everybody today?
I can breathe.
Still alive.
Yes.
Alive in here.
It's since we've last recorded, we've experienced daylight saving time here in the Pacific Northwest, and it was actually daylight when I got to the comic book store today. Of course, it's dark now, but it's only a matter of time until we're recording and it's still daylight outside.
Well, Ben, that's because when you go inside, the sun goes away.
Aww. Actually, yeah, when I...
Yeah!
I don't usually see the sun because I'm inside.
Yeah. But. I'm one of those Seattleites who I appreciate the grayness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And this winter has been one of the grayest on record, and we've had like so much like record-breaking rain, and I'm all for it.
And some snow.
What's the phrase for people who love rain? I have to go look it up. It's something philic. Anyway,
rain.
I just know that I like feeding on the suffering of others, and I really, really, really love it when people complain nonstop about the rain. So
in the
it warms your cold dead
it
heart.
It does.
In the winter months when the sun is really low in the horizon, it has this way of just poking into my window at work and it's like being right on my face, and I hate it. And you have a word.
Pluviophile.
If
you love the rain, you are a pluviophile.
Right, well, you're only happy when it rains.
Hey, I like
then you have good,
too.
Well, good,
but are you only happy
music?
When it's yeah. complicated?
Anyway.
Aren't they playing? Friends. They're playing. Their garbage is playing in town.
Yeah.
I thought they already came and
went.
Oh, yeah. They're going to be playing at like some schmoozy winery or something
right.
up north,
yeah.
I think. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Schmoozy. Garbage is in a schmoozy winery band.
But I bet there's money there.
Okay. Yeah. I bet there is. All right. Well, let's get on with the show, fellas and ladies.
You can
ladies.
Call me a fella. It's okay.
Okay.
Again,
well,
gender fluid.
All righty.
We've done this before.
We have, and I will step on my tongue every single time. All right. Well, let's talk and let's it feels like a weird segue to go into our first topic, but Bernie Wrightson passed away recently, and we want to acknowledge that.
Yep.
Cole Hornaday, who was Bernie Wrightson?
Bernie Wrightson was a groundbreaking horror illustrator. I think he started his career in the late 50s, maybe even earlier, but a lot of people know his work, of course, from the original Swamp Thing that he co-created with Len Wein. And he drew Swamp Thing starting in 1972, only 10 issues, believe it or not. And I was talking to John, our beloved friend and fan, John Boylan.
John
Swamp. That's right, John Swamp Thing Boylan. And I think, if I remember correctly, he told me that, well, he actually interviewed Bernie for his fanzine.
Yeah.
And one of the takeaways he got from talking with Bernie was that Bernie got bored. Bernie got bored drawing Swamp Thing, and it wasn't that he was not feeling creatively fulfilled, it's that he simply got bored. And if you look at his later work, if you've ever had the benefit of like really poring over the Mary Shelley's Frankenstein book that he drew in the 70s.
That was my first exposure.
Yeah. And actually that book inspired me to actually read the novel, and I read that version, I read the illustrated, you know, and it's the detail in it is absolutely phenomenal. It's the kind of detail that you would drive a mere mortal to insanity.
Mm-hmm.
I think.
Yep.
Just got bored, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. And when you look at his work, you can see why, because he's got to have an opportunity to take his time and just go all the way to the rivets with his drawing.
Does it show?
Every blade of grass.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Does it show
at
the end of Swamp Thing? Yeah. He was getting bored?
That's a really good question.
I would say probably not, because he's so professional.
Yeah. But he's also, I mean, he went on to do work that wasn't deadline driven. He started a studio with like Mike Kaluta and some other people. And there's this beautiful book that's been long out of print called The Studio. And he did these beautifully ornate, detailed illustrations of dinosaurs. And when I was a kid, I had this huge poster of a Diplodocus rising out of the water with little seagulls on its back. It was one of my favorite things. It's this beautiful simplicity of the design. But I'm talking a lot. Did someone else want to talk about Bernie? The saddest thing. Go ahead.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's worth mentioning that
I could talk about it for a long time.
The Frankenstein book, Dark Horse reprinted that, mm-hmm. and they made a beautiful cloth bound edition. Mm-hmm. And I'll always recommend that because I remember when I was young, for whatever reason, my mom bought that edition for herself, the original older version, and I would just kind of stare at the pages forever and ever, and. Eventually, they made giant prints too, like mm-hmm. huge prints of those mm-hmm. scenes, and that's it. Just it's enough to pull you into the world of Mary Shelley, mm-hmm. but just into his entire career.
And I looked at that book for 20 years or more. I picked it up at a used bookstore back in the 80s, so it was longer ago than 20 years. But I realized that
weird, right?
Yeah. So, but a friend said you really should read the novel, and I was planning to go see the stage adaptation they were doing at Book It, and I'm like, you know, I should just read the book. I should read the book, and my concern was that his illustrations would somehow distract me or change how I was envisioning the actual language, her language, and it didn't. If anything, it enhanced it, and that was one of the first times that's ever happened. But before we wrap up talking about him, I do want to talk about the last project that he did, which was called Frankenstein Alive Alive, that was being done through IDW, which was written by Steve Niles and was their sequel to Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. And when he started it in 2012, I remember having this conversation with Nicole. It's like, I don't know if he's ever going to finish this book, because he's putting out an issue a year, mm-hmm. if that, or every 2 years, maybe.
And considering his age and not just laziness, really.
Yeah, and this is long before we knew about his brain tumor or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it was an inspired level of detail that we had not seen for decades and decades and decades. It was phenomenal. It is phenomenally beautiful. And it is incomplete. There are 3 issues out there. I cannot recommend them enough. Maybe, even if the story is incomplete, the artwork is truly inspired and is really, really amazing to look at.
Did you guys ever hear the Joss Whedon story about Serenity and Bernie Wrightson?
No.
So for those of you who've never seen Firefly or Serenity, there's...
Get a life.
There's,
you need to start living.
Or you need to get over it.
There's
2 episodes. Continue.
Oh, they're worth getting to, so, yeah. So you can get to this part. Yeah. There's space boogeymen called the Reavers, who are supposed to be frontier men who have gone insane, and they eat you, skin you, and torture you, and not necessarily in an order that you would like.
Yeah, it's more clever than that. They'll eat you, skin you, and they'll skin you. Wait, they'll kill you, skin you, and eat you. And if you're lucky, they'll do it in that order.
Yes. So they never really show up during the TV series. And they were finally going to show up in the movie for Serenity. And so Joss Whedon was going over these sketch designs, and he was like, man, that's scary, that's not. And then he hit some that were like really beautiful, and he's just like, man, these remind me of Bernie Wrightson. And the people giving him the sketches were like, that's the name attached to these. And he's like, this is what we're doing.
Boom.
This is our design. So just Bernie Wrightson's kind of quick throwaway horrible designs are still like, this is utterly fantastic for a movie.
Yep.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's crazy. I didn't realize that he'd only done 10 issues of Swamp Thing. And growing up, I wasn't really versed in a lot of pop culture, but I knew who Swamp Thing was.
Mm-hmm.
So, Bernie Wrightson, 1948 to 2017, and we've also, in the past couple of weeks, we've talked about the Alien franchise, not mentioning the passing of Bill Paxton, which I want to acknowledge. So that's another sad one, because I liked all of, like, almost everything he did.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I appreciated seeing him in.
Yep, he was, I mean, think about things like Near Dark, the vampire world, the kind of pseudo vampire movie that he did with Lance Henriksen. And he's also in Predator 2, and he's in all these films that kind of fit in the same universe. What else am I leaving out? There was Predator 2, there's Aliens.
Terminator. Yeah, we mentioned,
that's right, he is in Terminator.
He's the only one who's been killed by a Terminator, a Predator, and an alien.
Second. Yeah, well, he's the first, but there is a second. Lance Henriksen.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
Henriksen is in a lot of those films, too.
Yeah. So.
Yeah.
There's a world out there where Bill Paxton and Lance Henriksen just assume the singularity.
This should, actually, that universe of our cinema universe should just be called the Paxton verse from now on.
Yeah. I agree. Yeah, all right. He had a rare charm.
You heard it here first. It's the Paxton universe. All right, moving on. DC is going to have a big summer event. They're calling it the next seminal Batman story. And in a panel at next week's Fan Expo Dallas, they're going to be live streaming the announcement. Who's going to tune into that? We're all shaking our heads.
Well, we all shrug.
Funny to me because the event's called like the Dark Forge or something like that, and it's like a kind of future Batman story. Mm-hmm. But it's just kind of like the entire point of Rebirth was to kind of get away from darkness, and they're like the next dark event. You're like, what?
And it's so rock and roll too, Chris.
Oh, really? Right. That's what it said.
But what kind of rock and roll?
I don't know. I don't care. I don't really want rock and roll with any of my superheroes, so I just thought, with like, oh, it's kind of corny.
Maybe it's just Batman teaming up with Kiss, you know?
Oh, because we need that.
Yeah.
We need that. Yeah. We need that so badly.
Does Archie show up? Because then maybe.
Yeah.
That's a twist.
I mean, let's talk mashup.
If it's Batman and Josie, then game over.
Right?
Okay, but stop. But like evil witchy vampire Josie or...
I don't know. I kind of want.
Or
like,
do we want sweet, serene, you know,
kitty cat outfit?
Kitty cat outfit.
Kitty cat outfit. Yeah, Josie.
Leopard tails.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kitty little cats. Yeah, it's just it's
with the ears.
Twist.
They're basically drawn like Archie, and then it moves over to this like hyper detailed Batman.
This is working for me.
See, obviously we like this better than this live.
Yeah, no, I'm digging. I'm picking up what you're throwing now. Don't get me wrong.
Fan fiction is happening.
Do we know? Does it exist? It's a whole new. Are we supposing it's a whole new future continuity thing or?
Are we talking about our fan fiction or about the real thing?
The Batman.
They don't say.
Okay.
Scott Snyder told Newsarama that the event's going to be a capstone for his Batman run with Greg Capullo, who's returning to DC. But it's happening on Sunday, April 2nd. This episode's being released on Monday the 3rd, so it already happened by the time this is being released. But
I'm just curious because I really like the Batman Beyond animated series. It really was a little bit better thought out, and the future context actually worked in that it sat on the same shelf with the Batman animated series. But you know, because DC can't leave a good thing alone, they turned it into a comic book. And I guess is the comic book still running?
Yep, still running right
now.
And
is it still? How are the sales on it?
It's doing okay. It's because they just rebirthed about 3 months ago, 2 months ago, something like that. And they
rebirthed
become a verb.
Times
they rebirthed
within New 52 as well, right? Or were there just different Batman Beyond titles?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Great.
Yes.
Okay. Everything.
Okay.
It's all right. Every woman. It's all.
I gave it a couple of tries, and it's like, well, you know, I like the TV show, but I don't need a comic book of it. So,
Cool. All right. So stay tuned for that. If you care. moving on, there's some news coming out of Lionsgate. They're rebooting Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, although I think they're just calling in the Power Rangers now. But this
Power
is making
Rangers.
News because it's going to be the first big budget superhero movie with an LGBT protagonist. It's Yellow Ranger, Trini, second act, she's going to come to terms with her sexual orientation.
I think it's also worth mentioning that I watched a promo video for them, and they also have an autistic ranger.
Oh, do they?
I can't remember which one it's supposed to be, and they don't overplay it. They just, it's a part of him. It's there. Mm-hmm. So
I think that's probably one of the better ways to handle something like this is to not make it a thing, but to just make it, you know.
Tonight on a very special episode of the Power Rangers.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Don't make it a very special episode. Just it is what it is.
Yep.
I think especially if you're looking at representation.
Yeah.
The people who want the representation don't need it banged over their head.
Right.
They just want the characters there to be natural, not like, spotlight! Yeah, so.
Cool.
But
all
at
right.
the forefront, which is nice.
Right.
Totally, yeah.
So has anybody seen the Power Rangers movie?
No.
Probably
it was never a. I'm too old for the Power Rangers.
Me, I'm way too old.
I think Nicole and I are like 2-3 years past.
A little, like, yeah, a yeah. little too late for us, because like, I had friends who were a little younger than me.
Yeah, I think the sweet spot right now would be 27 to 32.
Yeah.
You know?
Because the target audience, people that are going to see it, are not happy with it, from what I've heard.
Oh, really?
So, yeah. Yeah. Mm. So.
And I think I've heard some pretty decent reviews.
Yeah.
From,
just kind of depends. Yeah, crowds. I heard that at the end, the original Power Ranger theme song plays while they're zording out or something. So, okay. I don't
little
know if
fan
that's
service.
Good. So, yeah, a little fan service.
Yeah, I think if I was a fan of that, I would probably be losing it in the theater if that happened. So, that's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. And in 2018, so less than a year from now, which it sounds like it should be forever away, San Diego Comic-Con is going to open a comics museum in San Diego. It's taking over an old sports Hall of Champions in San Diego. Of course, how big can a San Diego Hall of Champions be? Am I right?
Oh, see, because my question was going to be, like, is that a bad thing for you being the sports guy?
No,
of course,
well,
you're going to get crickets here. From
Well, they have two major sports teams, the Padres, which generally bring in the basement of the National League West, and the San Diego Chargers, which always threaten to move to L.A. anyway, a comic book... museum. Now, this actually brought up something that I wanted to ask y'all. What would belong in a Comic-Con museum? What artifacts would you want to find if you were walking through the halls of a comic book
Jack
museum?
Jack Kirby's desk.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. That was the first thing I thought of. Because if you've ever seen pictures of that man's desk,
it looks like a torture.
I never have.
It's like covered in it's the surface is black from all the black ink that he used, and it's pitted and scraped, and I think it's probably the same desk that he sat at, you know, his entire career. I'd like to believe it was. That was the first thing I thought of, is wouldn't it be lovely to have Jack Kirby's desk? Was it two summers ago, I went to the EC Comics exhibit down at the University of Oregon.
Was that already two summers ago?
I think so.
Okay.
Yeah. Was it? Yeah, summer before last. But that, to answer your question, Ben, show me comic book history that we're not going to find anywhere else. Don't show me crap that's been on, you know, sound bites on the news or whatever. Show me original artwork, you know. Show me, and that was one of the things that just blew my mind open, was to have this opportunity to look at Jack Davis's original pencils and inks, and Wally Wood's, and the detail and that went into all of this, and the thumbnails of, and you know, brainstorming ideas on a napkin. I love that stuff. I love being able to come that close to that moment of inspiration that those people had.
Yeah, and something like the process, like the penciling and the inking, and kind of having a educational display of showing how comics work and the behind the scenes that way.
Yeah.
I want Stanley's ego, and I think it'd be like a ball of energy.
An orb.
And it would have to be like an anti-gravity chamber.
Yeah.
And like steel plates, and you have to kind of like look carefully, but only for a little while before the radiation gets you.
Oh my God, when he passes away, he's going to be like the Wizard of Oz. He's just going to be a giant holographic head. Excelsior! Yes. And you're like, ah! Yeah. You see behind the curtain, somebody just like, don't look! Don't look!
I imagine that people who are, you know, more recent fans of comics and the cinema will want to see, you know, an Iron Man costume and stuff like that.
Sure.
Because there just was not a lot of media back in the 50s and the 60s.
I'll bet you money that one of the opening displays will be an Infinity Gauntlet replica, or the original Infinity Gauntlet, just because.
Yeah. I'd like to see like all these first issues we keep hearing about, like Action Comics number one, you know.
Oh my!
And just all these actual artifacts.
You would need it donated. Which so interesting thing is that some of the original artwork to some of Steve Ditko's Spider-Man was donated to the Library of Congress. Mm-hmm. So there's stuff like that happens. And
well, you know, I heard a story about that.
Yeah, I've heard. I have guesses.
Okay, did you hear the story from me?
No.
So when that same trip I just mentioned earlier, there's a theory that Marie Severin, who was the inker at Marvel and at EC, she walked away with them. And she
like on accident?
Nope.
Oh, they fell into my purse.
Nope, because those people had no retirement, you know. And that she kept a couple of them and sold them and created a nest egg and then donated the rest of them to the Library of Congress.
Hmm.
You know, because Ditko doesn't care. He's he's an Ayn Randian.
See, the story in my head that I actually just love is that because he has people hounding him constantly for the artwork, and he's been known to destroy them to spite people.
Wow. Yes.
So my dream
That's the story anyway. Yeah.
My dream is that he decided, like, how do I make sure this never gets in the hands of a collector?
Oh, that's a good story,
I donate it to the to the Library of Congress. Yours is slightly more believable.
So spite or some other kind of spite.
Yeah, levels
either
of spite.
Way, yeah, it's levels of spite.
Well, the stories about him using, you know, the original illustration boards from Spider-Man as his cutting boards supposedly is not true.
Oh, goodness.
But who knows, because he won't talk to anybody. There was a very recent article a fellow wrote about basically camping out and trying to interview Ditko.
There's a documentary about that.
Oh, is that what it was?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's actually, I think it's one of our future episodes. We're going to talk about some people who may have been forgotten.
Forgotten
artists.
So that's right.
We might come back to Mr. Ditko and Maurice Everett.
So back to what we would like to see in this museum. Also, you know, maybe one of Kirk Allen's Superman costumes from the TV series or Steve Reeves. Or George Reeves', costume from the TV show.
Yeah.
You know, that would be kind of cool. Mm. Or, God grief, the Batman costumes from the movie serials.
Yeah.
You know, that, you know, who knows if those exist anymore?
So, like a wing of the movie or TV adaptation.
Yeah, because they're going to have to cycle stuff. So, essentially, the Batmobile can make its way there. Each Batmobile can make its way there.
Mm-hmm. That would be kind of cool.
That would be really cool.
But that would take up a lot of space.
Yeah. That's half the display. Yeah. You got a Batmobile. Yeah. Look at it.
I'd love to see a race of all the Batmobiles. Anyway, it's going to be in Balboa Park in San Diego. And it actually, they're saying it signifies a permanent home of Comic-Con International in San Diego. I know that there've been sort of mutterings of them leaving San Diego.
It's funny because this is like a power play thing.
Yeah.
This is them being like, no, we want you to stay here. Have a whole museum.
All right. And finally this week, friends, Marvel released their Iron Fist TV show, part of the Defenders series, and it's not getting very good reviews. And we were talking about this before we started recording today. I have not seen it. Cole, you have...
I've seen the first,
three episodes.
Oh, and, have and you seen Nicole it? Has, too.
Have you seen the entire thing?
Almost.
Almost.
I'm almost
through it. What do we think?
Well, it's interesting. So there's like the Metacritic score, which is kind of like the Rotten Tomatoes, I guess, right? But for critics, was like an 18%. And then like the viewer rating was like 85%, something like that. Like it was that far of a difference. And it looks like it just got super panned before it had even come out.
Yeah.
And I didn't get a chance to really look too deep into the reviews. Plus, I wanted to keep my murder rage a little lower for the week. You know, it's just it's a long week. I've loved the series, and I actually think it's one of the stronger Netflix shows.
Okay.
The problem that I had said before was that I was worried about pacing.
Right.
And the pacing is doing okay. It's stronger than like Luke Cage. Luke Cage kind of meandered and dwindled a bit for me, and then picked right up again. I would say that the only critique I have is that because they have to give everybody a season to kind of set them up, I think that this falters a little bit, because I think you want to see Danny Rand just be like, I got this. I'm going after the Hand. I'm going to punch him ups. And he's doing some of that, but he's not like super excelling. Like you don't see him like, oh my God, this guy is not to be trifled with. You don't quite see that. So that's, and I think that's just because he's just back after being in the seventh dimension of heaven or whatever he does.
And would you fault that as in the writing or in the performing? Because I've heard a lot of people complaining about Finn Jones's is it Jones?
I think so. Yeah,
his, Finn Jones. Complaining about his basically his performance.
His martial arts is not as tight as it should be.
No.
I think for the character, it's a little loose. especially because they have some martial artists that show up. Like, you can tell these people are legit, and they look a little stronger than him. So I think they probably should have cast a martial artist.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think Finn is one. So, but it's fine. It's okay. But I wouldn't, if I was like a huge martial arts fan, and I like martial arts a lot, I think it would disappoint me a little bit more. But I think that the fault of Danny not being like super powerful is probably in the way that they're designing the shows.
Okay.
and not necessarily Finn's problem.
Okay.
Because Finn sounds like a Danny to me. He just, like, sure. I hear his voice and I just hear
I'm Danny. In total agreement with Nicole. I watched the first three episodes last night, and I was kind of watching and going, I don't get what the beef is. Yeah, we're going to have some major problems with representation, but my viewpoint on both or a lot of these characters that we're seeing being you know, translated into film on Netflix is they weren't particularly inspired source material. I mean, it wasn't until Frank Miller got his hands on Daredevil that the world cared, you know. And the thing to remember is that Luke Cage and Danny Rand, Iron Fist, those characters were inspired by the grindhouse movies that the inner city kids were going to see at that time. And Marvel said, "Let's cash in on this," you know. The beauty of the Luke Cage series is that you got some really inspired writers who took on that material and made it their own. Unfortunately, we're not seeing that with the Iron Fist show. In fact, a friend of mine posted on social media last night. He said, "I feel like I'm watching the first draft." And I agree with that. It's like these scripts needed a little bit more work. But I am still enjoying it. And one of the things I'm enjoying is that I wish they'd bumped up the stakes on was that, why did he come back? Why did he leave heaven? Why did he leave Kunlun? Mm-hmm. He came back to find his family.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the tragedy of the story that I never got before.
Mm.
And they're just kind of, you know, and he meets these people that he thought about for decades who now run the corporation, and they're major, major a-holes. And that's tragic. And I saw that in the third episode. And you see his heartbreak a little bit, but the stakes were not as high as they could have been for me.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what the show is about, is him trying to find his family.
Yeah.
That will motivate me to watch a show.
And the supporting cast are really
strong.
The gal
who plays Colleen Wing is marvelous. I think she's just
great. I have
great.
To say, this is the first Netflix show that hasn't made me very disappointed by the women in it. Because a lot of times they're either incompetent or they're enablers of abusive people or they're annoying and naggy or something like that.
Right.
And this is the first where they're strong, independent, intelligent, very capable women. If they just walked away from the whole thing, they'd be fine.
Yep.
As opposed to these other women where I'd be like,
I'm going to keep watching it. I have never really cared for the Iron Fist character. I was telling Chris earlier tonight, the only time I ever cared was when Ed Brubaker got his hands on the character. And what did you say about the writing he did for Immortal Iron Fist? You said something pulpy?
He introduced the pulp fiction era Iron Fist. So there was legacy of Iron Fist.
That's right. That's
and that's the thing. The pulp fiction old man Iron Fist, who was grumpy and smoked a lot and whatever, was much more entertaining.
Yep.
Because he had guns that he infused with the power of the fist. And they have like a great moment where like Danny's doing like all these different martial arts moves and they're all being named, like the deadly crane move, and blah, blah, blah. And then the guy is with the guns is just shooting people left and right. And he's like, "This is for that guy and for the woman I loved and that person and that one kid." What was that kid's name? God, I can't remember that kid. And it goes on for a while. So it's just like you introduced a much more interesting character who was also an Iron Fist.
Right.
And I don't have to read Danny. So.
Well, and the good news is they do reference the other Iron Fists. So there's potential chance that, you know, maybe there could be some.
Just want an old fart with guns to show up.
Yeah. I mean, hopefully there'll be more interesting characters. I mean, I think the world has a lot of potential in the Netflix series. So.
See, and I think in that case, Brubaker said, you know, this character is really hollow. Let's beef up the history of the Iron Fist itself.
The legacy.
The legacy. Yeah. And in so doing, you know, gave a little bit more validity to Danny. I really liked those stories. I thought they were really fun.
Is there any hint of a fat cobra?
Not necessarily yet.
Okay.
But I'm watching it with William, and he said he had mentioned Fat Cobra, and I don't even think he's watched the Brubaker stuff, but he knew him.
Okay.
And he was just like, maybe a Fat Cobra could show up, because I heard that guy's cool.
That's a cool guy, That's a good guy.
Is Rosario Dawson in it?
Of course she is. Night Nurse is everywhere.
Yep.
She's the Nick Fury of the Defenders.
Yeah.
And she's great. She's great, so.
All right.
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Well, that's Iron Fist, and let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And Cole Hornaday, let's start with you.
Oh gosh. Well, I'm.
You have a pile of things in front of you.
I have a huge pile, guys. I am mired in researching 1950s pre-comics code horror comics, because that's the next episode of the Panel Jumper that Ben and I will be making for November. So I guess what I want to talk about is.
The next few weeks will be easy reviews.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I will talk about Four Color Fear, and this is a reprint collection from Fantagraphics. I believe it's in the second print. Did Chris and I
think so,
Chris,
yeah.
Did you and I agree that it's in the second print?
At least it has a different cover. So
yeah, we'll so this is it was originally published in 2010, and these are this is just a huge tome full of lost works, for the most part, of pre-code comic books, horror comics that. You know, filled the newsstands. That's something to remember about this time period, is that there were over 30 publishers grinding out over a million comic books a year. So, a lot of them were these horror comic books that were just, you know, some of them, like EC, they put some effort into what they were doing, and others like, I don't know, The Black Cat and Ghostly Weird and Weird Tales of Terror and Weird Mysteries and Mr. Mystery and Mr. Strange Terrorism. This is a really, really fun book. There are some notables in it, like Jack Cole, the fellow who created Plastic Man, and Jack Katz, who went on to work at, or who also worked at EC. But then, you know, some of my favorites, like Basil Wolverton, who I just think captures nightmare imagery so successfully. But one of my favorite stories in this lot, and this is a dense book, is a piece called The Green Horror. What was it, this horror? Was it vegetable, mineral, animal? Or just a fiend out of the lower darkness? It had the cunning and patience of death itself as it waited for the helpless victims. Okay, basically, this is a story of a jealous giant killer cactus.
I love it.
And it's marvelous. Just,
the picture of this cactus randomly showing up behind people.
I
needs
think
to
we
be adapted.
Do radio theater. That of this. I'll just be the woman screaming in the background.
Awesome. Yeah, and it's this, and it's about this couple driving through the desert, and the woman says, "You want me to turn it around?" And
No. It's carrying an axe.
Yeah, and the woman says, wife's like, "Oh, I love that cactus, honey. Here, let's uproot it and take it home with us."
Oh,
and it develops an identity and starts getting jealous and keeps killing off, you know, her husbands and stuff like that. And it's just marvelous.
The man goes to axe the cactus, and the cactus yanks the axe out of his hand.
Yes.
And kills him with it.
And then it embraces her.
An axe.
Then it embraces her in its prickly arms, and the police show up the next day, and there is her body lying on the ground
being hugged to death by this cactus. It's a great ending panel.
Yeah, it's good stuff. So, and unfortunately, some of the stories in here are not that coherent. Some of them just sort of take little detours, but all told, I recommend Four Color Fear. It is back in print. Four Color Fear, Forgotten Horror Comics of the 1950s.
All right, cool. Thank you, Cole. I want there to be a sequel to that where it's a robotic cactus and it's called Cacti Robot.
Oh.
Yeah, I've been building up to that.
We'll get right on that.
All right. Thank you, Cole. Four Color Fear. Nicole Lamb, what do you got for us?
So I picked up Black Masks, issues 1 and 2 of The Dregs. And of course, I didn't write down who was doing it. I can grab that eventually. But this series, or Chris is going to help me. This series starts off with a slaughterhouse scene, except that instead of other animals that we usually use, it's a man.
Mm.
And so there's kind of this like Soylent Green as people moment, because the next scene is a fancy restaurant where they're serving meat. So
long pork.
It's the long pork, yeah. So this is written by Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler, and the pencils and inks are by Eric Zawadzki, and colors by D. Kunafi. Y'all keep testing me with these last names. And it was printed in Canada, very important. It actually takes place in Vancouver, Colombia, British Columbia. And it's in this area that's like Skid Row. A lot of homeless people, and they're all high on this, like, this drug called Listerine or something like that. And it focuses in on this one guy who is running around trying to find out what happened to his friends. His friends are missing. People he knew, just all of a sudden, all these people going missing. And he's kind of working on this conspiracy, but of course nobody wants to listen to him or talk to him because he's a crazy, hallucinating, drug-riddled, you know, homeless man. And meanwhile, in the same area, there's all of these fancy restaurants popping up all around town. So it still doesn't give too much away in the series, but you know, obviously as the reader, you get a lot more of what's going on there. But it's just curious because he's actually a pretty interesting guy. And there's a moment where he's walking in an alleyway, and this one of the rich, you know, affluent looking women shows up, and they have this conversation. Like, she understands what's happening and maybe wants to work with him, but you don't really know much about her. You don't know if maybe she's a hallucination. At some point, he's walking around, his feet are bleeding, and she shows up and takes him into an apartment, and it becomes this 1950s sort of PI detective kind of back and forth with this beautiful woman.
It's like a film noir,
very film noir
Venetian blind shadows cast over him.
Yeah, and meanwhile, I think she's like trying to give him drugs to make him feel better, like, you know, pump him up with whatever the stuff is. So it's got these interesting twists and turns, and I like the panel work on it. It does very simple paneling. The color wash over it is this sort of gritty, you know, there's like taupes and, you know, navy blues. And
so does it have a vegan dent to the story? Is that the point? Or is that just...
No, I don't think so. I don't really know exactly what the whole thing is. I mean, obviously it's a conspiracy that's going to unfold as it goes on. But it really piqued my interest. I do like and support Black Mask, but not everything hits for me.
Yeah. Right.
There's only a few things that really do. And this one I just thought was a kind of interesting take on stories that we've kind of heard already, but it's still engaging. And I think there's a good team on it. So I'm going to definitely keep up with it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Is Black Mask a Canadian publishing company?
No, I think they're in America.
I think they are America.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just wondering.
A lot of companies print, Canadian print houses, though, out in the prairies.
Yeah, this is the studio. I think they're actually based in New York City. Matt Pizzello, Brett Gerritz. He was the lead singer of Bad Religion. And Steve Niles, who we know, Steve Niles does a lot of horror stuff. They've teamed up and created this publishing house. We've talked about them before with the punk rock values and stuff. So,
All right. The Dregs, 1 and 2 from Black Mass. Thanks, Nicole. And finally, Chris Casseau, what do you got for us?
So I read the first issue of a 4-issue miniseries from Kaboom, and it is called Brave Chef Brianna. And it is created and written by Sam Sykes and illustrated by Selena Espiritu, colored by Sarah Stern. And there seems to be a growing sub-niche of comics these days that are about food.
Yeah.
And and I love it.
Chefs.
I think it's like the best thing ever.
Gotta rope the foodies.
And so this one is kind of a fantasy mashup, and it follows this... there's a family, and you never really see most of like the father or the main family. He's got like 20 children, and he knows he's going to die soon, so he makes a contest for all of them, and whoever opens and maintains a successful restaurant for a year gets like the family cooking empire. And he has one daughter among all these boys. And Brianna is the main character, and she has a huge anxiety problem. It's manifested in a little black cloudy sprite that's always telling her that she's stupid and she can't do stuff. And she instantly thinks she's going to fail this task because she's just doesn't have the confidence. And she gets a random email that tells her, like, you should open your restaurant in Monster City. So apparently there's a whole city full of monsters there. And she rents out this place, and, like, the landlord doesn't meet her, but the landlord's daughter does, and the landlord's daughter is a harpy. And the harpy's like, yeah, you're going to hire me now because, you know, I'm the landlord's daughter and I need a job. And they build, like, a really cute restaurant, and they get their first customer, and it's like a nice boy from an office, and he eats like one of the hamburgers, and doves appear all over the scene because it's such a heavenly hamburger. She's just like, oh, it's free on the house for your first customer. He's like, I'd rather pay because I might be the only customer you ever get. And she's like, what? He's like, it's Monster City. They don't eat human food. And she's like, what? And like, but her harpy coworker is just like, yeah, it's almost like this is Monster City and not Humansville. And she's like, what? And it just keeps on getting worse. And it's like, yeah, didn't you read the bylaws? And there's a Necronomicon with a mouth screaming, no child of the city shall allow the taste of man's flour, nay sugar, nay cooked meat to touch their lips. So she's pretty much doomed, and the anxiety sprite like multiplies and becomes this horrible creature, which is a great way of manifesting that. And then the guy brings his monster friends in, and they eat the food that she tries to make without those ingredients, and it's horrible. And then she does something off panel, and now they all see flying doves of magical goodness as they eat the hamburgers. And so it's just a setup, but it's pretty adorable.
And what do you think she does off panel?
She might be cooking with gluten-free flour or something like that.
Wow.
It sounds marvelous. It sounds like the creators actually sat down and brainstormed with their 7-year-olds or something.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. Because it's like, that's kid logic that adults need more of in their lives.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And it ends with, like, there's this giant snake lady who's seen the man-eater reviews of the restaurant, and she's like, no, not this time. They drove us out of our homes to the city, but not this time. So, Brave Chef Brianna is pretty fantastic.
It's four issues,
and it's only $3.99. So, yeah, if you liked Rutabaga or Space Battle Lunchtime, keep on getting the food comics.
Okay. All right.
I just have to say that I love both of y'all's recreations of things, and I kind of want to just have like a little story time where we just find like panels we really loved and like read them with our voices, with all the magical voices.
What do you say, Ben?
Coming soon. Pergabon Podcast Radio Theater.
Yes.
Comic book radio theater.
Read along. Let's read the Necronomicon.
Yeah. Right. Nothing bad can happen from
cool.
that.
All right. Brave Chef Brianna. Thanks, Chris. Well, that is Bookport, and that is our show. And coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to tell you that the Perfect Bomb Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, where you can buy tickets to the upcoming Panel Jumper Live Friday, April 14th at 8 p.m. west of Lennon. Go to thepaneljumper.com for tickets and information. We're going to talk more about it in depth in the next episode. And also brought to you by the Comic Extension here, 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicextension.com. Find us, like us, follow us on Facebook and Twitter, however you get your social media. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. Did you absolutely hate Iron Fist and you want to argue with our panel? Email us.
Bring it on.
Bring it.
We
want the discussion. All right. And get your quiz hats on. It's quiz time. And this week our questions come to us from Mr. Cole Hornaday. Lay it on us, Cole.
So this week's quiz time is titled, He Said What? Or I Do Solemnly Swear. Please match the known catchphrase or oath to the well-known character.
All right.
Here we go. As a child of the inner city streets of Harlem, Luke Cage, a.k.a. Power Man, undoubtedly learned more than his share of colorful phrases, but this holiday call-out was the one that stuck.
Sweet Christmas.
Sweet Christmas is correct. Editor-in-chief Perry White undoubtedly had much to swear about when it came to publishing the Daily Planet in the days before Spellcheck and Adobe Creative Suite, and turned to ancient Rome for his oath's inspiration.
Great Caesar's Ghost.
Great Caesar's Ghost is correct. While writing, okay, this it's going to get a little bit tougher here, gang. I throw out some easy balls. While writing the animated Jack Kirby-rendered post-cataclysmic landscape with his companions, Princess Ariel and the Princess Ariel the Sorceress and Ookla the Mock, Thundar the Barbarian was particularly fond of howling this particular expletive.
Can I phone my husband?
No, you can't. Dang. Phone your... Anybody?
Not anybody? A clue.
Demon dogs! Oh, guys, I am so old. Robert E. Howard's black-haired, selenoid Sumerian, Conan the Barbarian, was often wont to cry out to the deities of his faith.
Crom.
Or?
By Crom.
Excellent. Is there another one?
By Mitra's gold. I don't know.
Oh, you are so close. Ishtar and Mitra. Ishtar. Yeah. Good job. Lastly, Douglas Adams offered up many oaths and expletives in his Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, but president of the galaxy and inventor of the pangalactic garble blaster, Zaphod Beeblebrox, was particularly fond of crying out the name of this intergalactic prophet and preternaturally late dinner guest. I'm sorry, you guys.
I have. I feel anybody? Bad. I don't know that one.
Great Zaquan!
Oh, nice.
Other acceptable responses would have been, "Oh, Zaquan!" Or, "What in the name of Zarking Thodbox?" Or, "For Zark's sake!" Or, "Holy Zaquan singing fish!"
Good grief.
Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, folks. Nice. Thank you very much for indulging me.
Thank you, Cole, and thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.